Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is an offering of the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition in partnership with KKRN Community Supported Radio here in Round Mountain, Bella Vista, and from our Reading studio. And this show is an opportunity to be in conversation with people who are interested in and working for criminal legal system reform from within the system and from outside of the system. And today we're speaking to one of the co-founders, original thought partners who brought the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition into its existence, really. Larry Olmsted, CEO and president of United Way of Northern California. And we're speaking to him in particular about a new initiative that United Way is launching, Building Bridges. Welcome, Larry. It's so good to have you here again.
Thank you, Sharon. It's an honor to be with you.
You know, I thought we'd begin by just introducing yourself in whatever way you feel is important to ground what we're going to talk about today.
Oh, absolutely. Sharon, I'm the president and CEO of United Way of Northern California. We're one of nearly 1,000 local United Ways in the United States, and our focus is on building thriving communities through looking at the building blocks of a good life: health, education, and financial stability. We pride ourselves on being here in the community during times of crisis and for people during times of crisis. We operate, for example, the 211 helpline, which is a 24/7, 365 resource. Call 211 and get access to information and referrals about any social service. I think it's important for people to know that United Way cares deeply about issues of equity. We're strongly anti-racist. We are against hate, and we are interested in taking a strong stand in those areas. I've been here as a CEO for 9 years now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were the original convener, the person who called together people to consider the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition. I wanted to ask you about that, but first, you know, in our current environment, which is the reason for the initiative we're going to talk about today, it feels like a bold move to say my organization is anti-racist, and maybe particularly in an area like ours. So I want you to, if you can, to talk about why that's important and what it takes to make that claim.
It's so strange in our nation, when you think about all our country has been through, in terms of the civil rights era, in terms of fighting a war against slavery, all that sort of thing. And here in 2024, we're thinking it's bold to say that you're against racism. Mm-hmm. In a nation that is so... I wish it was a melting pot, but we certainly are... a nation with all kinds of people from all kinds of countries and national backgrounds and origins. So I think it is a sign of the times that we think that that is a bold statement, and mm-hmm. we think that standing up for democracy is a bold statement. But that's where we are, and that's okay. So for United Way, at least for our United Way, we have a phrase that we think about, that we use, called thoughtful boldness, and it is associated with our stance on equity. We're not crazy people. We're not, you know, far left radicals, but we certainly believe that in our nation and in our communities, we have a mix of people, and that mix of people must be called upon if we're going to successfully solve the issues and deal with the issues that confront us as a society. So in my view, it is riskier to sit on the sidelines than it is to say, hey, let's stand up for what we believe. And it's particularly true for United Way. United Way, if we're not a nonprofit, we're not a charity that, you identify with saving animals or you identify with fighting cancer or whatever, our relevance is really tied to, are we helping communities thrive? And in that context, if we're irrelevant, we're not going to exist. So to me, it is much, much riskier to take no stance and sit on the sideline and just watch communities not be all they can be.
Mm-hmm. And those were some of the same social forces that led you and the United Way to invite people to come together to talk about something like the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition. And I'm wondering if you could reflect on that moment and what it was that spoke to you so strongly.
Absolutely. Mm. You know, if you think back to 2020 and George Floyd and the George Floyd murder, if you will, really set the stage for this. And the thing that I remember most about that era, I remember a few things. One is our national president, the United Way's global president at the time, a guy named Brian Gallagher. And Brian was a white guy, and very much so. And he stood up and he said, "This is outrageous." The George, talking about the George Floyd thing, he said, "I'm angry. Everybody, every white person, everybody in the country should be angry about this." And I said, "You know, if that's Brian Gallagher standing up and making a strong statement," and he followed up with several things, I said, "There's no excuse for us here in the North State to take this on." The other thing about that era, and I think this speaks to our community and to United Way, it wasn't so much Larry Olmsted and United Way standing up. It was Eddie McAllister. "Hey, hey Larry, I've got Bill Shuler, the police chief. I got his phone number. Let's call him up and see what we can do. Get some people together." It was Scar pulling together a news conference involving a lot of the law enforcement leaders in our community, so forth and so on. In other words, it's a community coming together, right? And we simply provided, really a Zoom line for community leaders to get together. And then following that, many people said, "No, we want to keep on meeting and we want to keep on talking. These are critical issues." So that was really the impetus for getting going. And from the United Way perspective, it was pretty straightforward. As I was sitting there, I was thinking, this is a community that cannot afford an incident like George Floyd. We that would be way, way too destructive and distracting for our community with everything we needed to deal with, especially, remember, this is the outset of the pandemic.
Right.
So to me, it was like, what can we do as United Way and as a community to stave off that possibility? Or if there is an incident like that, we've got the lines of communication open with law enforcement as a community, where the community can talk to law enforcement can talk to the community in a constructive way, so we can head off some of the more destructive types of activities. So that was what really sparked it, and it is nice to see 4 years later, and really a lot of this is because of you, of course, Sharon, but 4 years later, where I think SCJC does have a voice, does have the lines of dialogue open with law enforcement. And, we want to continue to work to keep those lines open so that we don't have a repetition of that type of terrible incident.
Mm. I know we'll circle back to this when we talk about the initiative that you're here to talk about today, Building Bridges, but what were some of the barriers that you saw initially with a coalition of organizations working to address criminal legal system reform, and how has your perspective changed over time, if at all?
Yeah, I think initially one of the things that we saw was how this is a big and complex area, criminal justice and criminal justice reform. And a lot of people walk into it with preconceived notions. A lot of people walk into it with often anger and trauma based on whatever experiences they've had on either side of that equation.
Mm-hmm.
And So the first thing is, okay, if it's a complicated, complex issue, and we have people who are not, this isn't their full-time jobs, you know, whether SCJC or other, or just common citizens, people are busy, you know, so how do we find the time and the bandwidth to address this in a coherent way? We also know that our law enforcement agencies tend to at the time, especially law enforcement was getting beat up. Mm-hmm. So they're like, okay, well, we're going to be cautious, you know, in dealing with anybody who's giving us scrutiny or advice. So you saw that a little bit of that going on. You also have a community where this is overall, people here support law enforcement. So they see anybody who's coming in scrutinizing law enforcement as a potential threat. And I remember the first time I spoke to city council here in Reading about SCJC, and on my drive home, getting a text from somebody who I didn't even know, asking me why I was up there trying to defund the police, which was not something I said or even believed. Right. So that's the... those kinds of things were there. And, you know, you simply end up having to talk through that. You end up working through that. You end up building the trust. And I think one of the things that SCJC has been able to do is convince our top law enforcement officials in this region that SCJC is a sober organization committed to the community, committed to win-win solutions, and it's not perfect, and it's not going to be perfect, but the lines of dialogue are open, and mm-hmm. I think that's really important.
Yeah. One thing, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to articulate this, that strikes me when you're speaking is... There's such a range of perspectives within the SCJC and outside about what needs to happen, but there's more support for something like the crisis response intervention team, which is an investment in having social workers and those other kinds of high contact things, and they've been on the show. And the other is that there is dialogue, there's pushback, there's suggestions, there's conversations like we had with the sheriff on the show. But by and large, members of the coalition and others support the rule of law.
Yes.
And often encounter people who are resistant to hearing about the SCJC, but believe in their own rule of law or more... what we might call vigilante justice. And, you know, I know you've spoken a lot about just the importance of the rule of law and wondering if you have any reflections.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I don't think that there's any place for the whole vigilante kind of ideology. It's not necessary, and it's ultimately leads to bad things happening for all people involved in that type of activity, including the vigilantes themselves. That's not where we need to be as a society. And particularly here in the North State, I feel that the law enforcement agencies up here, on balance, are working hard to keep the public trust. I like to see some other reforms happen. RPD, Reading Police, they decided to implement the crisis intervention teams. I think they believe it's been a resounding success. This is where they send officers out with mental health professionals to deal with these kinds of situations that ultimately were ending tragically because police were not equipped with what they needed to be equipped with, and they end up, you know, they end up shooting people. Not so much in Reading, but around the country, this kind of thing was happening. And here in Reading, the police recognized that this was an opportunity for, again, a win-win for police and the community. They're safer. They end up handling situations better and so forth. RPD also went ahead and installed body cams. This is a hugely important reform. And again, it's a win-win for police. So where we need to be as a society in terms of the rule of law is I think, two places. One, establishing opportunities that make the community safer and police safer as they do their work. But then the other place is a rejection of the idea that people who want to operate outside the judicial system, outside the law enforcement system, it's not they're not looking for order. They are looking for power. They are looking for disorder. They are looking for control. And I think that especially in our communities, we are fortunate to have law enforcement, a pretty much overall a pro-law enforcement community. Mm-hmm. So I think that we need to reject that other stuff in the most firm way. The other thing, comment I would make, Sharon, I was appointed this year to the California Highway Patrol's Citizens Advisory Board. And this is a group that, you know, as the name suggests, they bring us together every quarter for a couple of days each quarter to go very in-depth in terms of the CHP operations. And they seem to take it very seriously. And they take the feedback very seriously. This is the reform that I think locally we need the most, that we need more civilian interaction and oversight of the police departments and of the sheriff's office, et cetera. And there we do get pushback. And what I would say is the more that our local law enforcement can reach out to the community and gain the buy-in and trust, the easier it'll be to move away from the thought that others need to come in and do police work or do vigilante kind of activities that others will, because other forces won't have the standing and trust in the community that's needed to participate in those kind of extra legal activities.
If you're just joining us, this is Bending the Arc on KKRN, kkrn.org, and I'm speaking with Larry Olmsted of United Way of Northern California. So we're here especially to talk about a new initiative that United Way is launching, the Building Bridges event. So let's begin with you telling us about what it will be and how it came about.
Absolutely. We're very excited about Building Bridges. What it will be is an effort. I think the goal of Building Bridges is pretty simple, and that is, we as a community, how do we establish a norm of civil, respectful, and inclusive discourse in our civic life? In other words, we can disagree, we can vote for whatever we want, our public leaders can, you know, do their thing and stand up for what they want to stand up for, but do it in a way that's civil, do it in a way that is respectful of all people, and do it in a way that does not push people away from the table, that brings people to the table and honors their points of view, even if you don't agree with them. We believe that nationwide, that we're obviously in a hugely polarized and divided political situation, and that does not benefit anybody. And certainly locally, again, we're not a community that can afford the level of divisiveness that we sometimes see. So in simple form, that's our goal. Now, what does it look like? It's going to look like a few things. One is we are at work creating a model of that people can utilize to gain the tools, to gain the perspectives needed to carry on conversations that are respectful, even if you disagree with somebody. And part of our goal is to, and maybe the challenge of our goal, is to push this model throughout the community, or models, because it'll be plural, throughout the community. So that you're going to see forums, you're going to see webinars, you're going to see workshops, you're going to see convenings in which we bring people together and we're talking and we're learning and we're figuring out how to do all of that in ways that are respectful. I think a second goal is to empower our grassroots organizations, because one of the things that we've seen is that a lot of the climate in Shasta County has gotten so difficult that a lot of our grassroots organizations are pulling back. They're not coming to the table with their ideas, with their solutions. They're keeping their heads down because they see an environment that they believe is intimidating and unwelcoming. So we want to help our grassroots organizations through learning, through funding, through leadership development, so that they become stronger. And they can sit at the table and make sure that their voices are heard. So I think that's another critical element in this work. And I think the final one that I'll mention is a critical element is really to mobilize the community around this issue. So you're going to see us, and we're already underway, enlisting community leaders, enlisting organizations, and enlisting the general public in simply, hey, stand up. We believe that 80%, 90% of our county residents want, just normal government to work well. And we believe that there is a minority that has what we call seized the narrative of Shasta County, and that narrative is going out to the rest of the nation as, you guys have crazy politics, right? and often incendiary kinds of dialogue going on. And that's not good for Shasta County. It discourages visitors from coming here. It discourages businesses from coming here. Discourages people from wanting to live here. That's not who we are, and well, at least not who we want to be, and not who we want everyone to see us as. So we're going to be doing a lot of work to assist anybody who wants to be part of that, to repair that image, and we need to mobilize the population as a whole to kind of demand of our leaders that, hey, you know, go ahead and disagree, but don't be disagreeable while doing it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, and you partly answered it just then, a couple times you've used the phrases, we can't afford to continue things as they are. And you just mentioned some of the costs of the discord, the very public and discord. And I'm wondering what other costs there are to not addressing some of this very vocal, violent, almost, discourse.
Well, and I don't want to focus or pick on the county government, but for us, a key origin point here, United Way considers Shasta County government as a critical partner. We serve pretty much the same constituency. Our 211 program is funded, largely by Shasta County government. And what we've found is that in this current climate, there's just a brain drain from county government that has trickled down to create a situation where at times it seems close to dysfunctional. The result of that has been key department heads leaving. It has been a lot of turnover within the departments, very fine professional people who, maybe now I'm in a role that was different. Now I've got a learning curve on that role. People are often concerned about bringing in new initiatives because they're not sure how those initiatives are going to be received and whether that will create any kind of career crisis for them and so forth and so on. And this is not just me talking. I mean, this is established. Pretty much everybody in county government understands that this is the scenario that they're working with. So there's what we found is that not just for United Way as a nonprofit organization, but for many, many people doing business with the county and organizations, this is an issue, right? And that's not good. That's not good for Shasta County at all. So that's one piece of it. And then you look overall at what occurs, whether it's on school boards, whether it's on commissions, whether it's on our municipal councils and so forth and so on. This is Larry Olmsted's view.
Sure.
There's a little bit too much time talking about issues that are not central to helping the community thrive.
Mm-hmm.
Where we have issues where we want close, focused conversation. Issues around homelessness is an example. Issues around, there's a good discussion now about mental health and substance abuse, some new funding possibly coming to the county. How do we deal with that? Those are critical issues right there, mental health and substance abuse, alcohol abuse. Those are critical issues in this county because we have a disproportionate amount of it, right? How do we continue to focus on, good education for our children? All those sorts of things. We want to focus on those issues because as much as we love Shasta County, we also know that we have a disproportionate high level of stress-related types of issues, of incarceration, of mental health and substance abuse, unfortunately, of issues around child abuse and neglect and so forth and so on. So we know as a community we have a population that's willing to band together and care for each other. We saw that with the car fire. We've seen it, just various things that come up, crises. Our community will pull together. We want to make sure that we can do that without the obstacles of unnecessary divisiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those all are issues where stigma, blame, and shame only make getting to the solutions more difficult.
Oh, absolutely. Right? I haven't seen any data on this, and I don't know how much data exists, but the one thing I'm very aware of, anecdotally at least, is that this is a community that has an LGBTQ population that is active, where people want to participate in civic life, where it's hard for me to know whether it's disproportionate or not, but certainly large enough to be important and impactful.
Mm-hmm.
We can't have a community where where those folks can't be at the table,
mm-hmm.
or aren't feeling a sense of intimidation, because that's where solutions come from. Our people of color, our Native American communities, our Latino communities, our disabled communities. We are a community. People think of Shasta County often as a monolith, but we're not. Okay, and we need all of those voices at the table to effectively address the issues that are at hand.
Mm-hmm. If you're tuning in just now, you're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio, and I'm in conversation with Larry Olmsted. So this episode will air after your kickoff event. There are two. Correct, here in Butte County,
That's right.
With Rich Hardwood. So I wanted people to know what that event is and what you hope will come out of it.
Thank you, yeah. We decided to make the public launch of Building Bridges an opportunity to hear from a national expert on doing this kind of work in communities. So we're bringing in Rich Harwood. Rich is the founder of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. He's relevant to this issue in a variety of different ways. Rich, what his organization does is that they go to communities across the country that are struggling with significant issues where leaders in the community need to build a greater sense of public trust. And what Rich's work is he and his team work with those leaders on techniques for listening to the needs of the community, bringing people together with an emphasis on dialogue and trust. So we feel like, oh yeah, this is what we're kind of interested in. To give you a sense, and your listeners a sense, the one example I always come back to is Rich being called into Newtown, Connecticut after that tragic Sandy Hook elementary school shootings. They brought Rich in to help the community facilitate the conversations about what to do with the school building in the wake of that tragedy. They ultimately tore that school building down and built a new school right on the same site. Rich is the kind of guy, his firm has gone into places like Flint, Michigan and Jackson, Mississippi to help those cities deal with the water crises that they had. So it happens that United Ways find themselves very closely aligned with the principles that Harwood Institute deals with. And one of the biggest ones is when dealing with the community, it is easier to build trust around the things that people have in common than the things that divide them. So the Harwood Institute preaches and teaches, hey, start first with what are the aspirations of the community? And so we here at United Way of Northern California, we're trained on Harwood principles and utilize them in our community outreach work. My previous United Way was San Jose, and I did a major Harwood project while I was there as well. So Rich is a good speaker. After the campfire, United Way had nothing to do with this, but after the campfire in Butte County, I believe it was the public library there that brought Rich in just as a one-off speaker. And he did a great job talking to folks about, hey, we've got all this sense of crisis here. How do you start finding the path forward through hope? So right now, Rich is on a national tour, pre-election, to say, hey, we know this is a divisive, kind of polarizing situation, but don't let that paralyze you. Don't let that paralyze your community. All of this is in a nonpartisan way. And so we think Rich is going to be an effective speaker and set the stage for the work that we're going to have to do going forward.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that there are several models, that this might roll out in different models. And I know you and your team, in beginning to imagine this, looked at a lot of different models and resources. What were some of the ones that stood out to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny because the two that come most quickly to mind, one is called Braver Angels. That's where, work is done. And actually the other one that comes quickly to mind is StoryCorps. And they both involve how do you find people who are on either side of an issue and kind of work with those folks to come together more closely. We have studied those and a few others. Here's what I've learned as we've done this work. There are a lot of there's different models. Well, I spent a lot of time with one called Convergence as an example. And convergence has like five or six layers of work that organizations do. And, you know, there's arrows pointing different ways and all that kind of thing. And then you have something like StoryCorps, which is me and you sitting across from a table for 45 minutes. And can we find some common ground? They all, though, have, no matter how complex or not, at the core of almost all of these models for constructive civic engagement is, how do we get people to sit down across from each other and talk to each other as human beings? Okay, that is really, to me, the core of all of it, right? So, and then if you can figure out techniques for doing that in a way that is constructive, then how do you scale that up, right? So that a critical mass of community leaders and community people can be engaged in that. So, one of the things that we found in doing this work, for instance, is rather than start out by saying, you know, why did you do that, or why did you vote for that, or why, you know, you must be crazy or whatever, or it's calling people names, a better place to start is, hey, tell me about yourself. Tell me about your background. Tell me about the experiences you've had so I can glean an idea about how you got to the place you're at. And when people do that and both sides are willing to put themselves on the table with that, then it's easier to say, okay, I disagree with you on that issue, but I now see some place for common ground, right? And, you know, what I found, this works. It sounds, a little Pollyannish, but this stuff actually works. And I found you take a hot button issue, abortion, let's say, or gun rights or whatever, it's not that hard to talk to somebody who doesn't agree with you on, let's say, an issue like abortion, but find five things you do agree on, okay? And then say, okay, that's interesting. I've had that background, too. I went to that school, too. I grew up there, too. Oh, okay. And then now you start talking like human beings, and you start seeing the possibilities for trust and coming together. One of the things that's key about building bridges is that we will not try to tell people to change their values or beliefs. But what we do want is put that on the table in a fuller way so that we have the context of understanding each other. And therefore, we can find a place to at least start building constructively.
One of the things that struck me about models like that is so important is almost the more that you care about a particular issue or you formed your values, the easier it is to make assumptions about why someone has a stance that they do. And you can't get to their why without those conversations, without truly listening.
Oh, absolutely. And experiences are powerful. I grew up in the Bronx, New York, and I've had certain types of jobs, certain types of roles, certain types of life situations. They're going to be different from just about anybody because we all have our unique experiences. And those experiences, you put a label on, so, oh, she's a liberal, or he's this, or he's... there's a whole set of experiences that might push you one way on a certain issue and another way on another issue. And when we start doing that labeling thing, then we are just losing the path of that complexity that could actually bring allies in, you know. I think the other thing about talking to each other as human beings and learning more about each other is simply it's the antidote to what we see with this racism, what we see with the stereotyping. I will try not to tear up, but this whole thing, for instance, over the Haitian immigrants that's in the election. I lived in Miami for 7-8 years. I believe the nation's largest Haitian population. I worked with Haitian immigrants closely, been in the community with those organizations, And the idea that anyone would sit down with these folks, who many of whom are just so hardworking, looking for the better life. I've been to Haiti. You know, United States, I'm sorry, does offer a better life in terms of, you know, the kind of unrest and situation they have there. Just like all the rest of us, well, not all of us, because some of us were brought here on boats, but most of us have come here to the United States looking for a better life. And you've got to look at these people as people, as human beings. And, you know, the broad brush of coming up with these caricatures that are so harmful is just really disappointing and wrong. So one of the antidotes to that kind of racist, stereotypical thing is to actually sit down with people and talk mm-hmm. to them and get to know them. And you're going to find out that, boy, oh, yeah, I've got a lot in common with these people. They love family. They want to work hard. They want the better life in America, you know, and just as starters.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brian Stevenson has one of his, you know, the calls to action at the end of his Just Mercy book, and he says, get proximate. And there is a lot of research about if you actually speak to a person. We did at the, when I was at the college, a human library event, and I know that one of your staff is interested in doing that as well, where you invite, people are books and typically represent something that's stigmatized in our society. And then when you actually speak to people and realize they are full humans worthy of dignity and respect, ideas can change.
Yes. You know, I part of my life experience was working as a foreign correspondent in South Africa during apartheid, just before the apartheid regime was dismantled. And I was a reporter, a journalist, so to me the job required you to keep as much of an open mind as you could, in that case about a political system that, you know, pretty clearly was racist and flawed. And I remember as part of that work, I found myself interviewing or sitting down with, of course, people from the apartheid regime up to and including the then president, P.W. Botha. What I learned from doing that is that these folks are human beings, just like everybody else. In fact, maybe more human in a lot of ways than some other people, because of the kind of you know, the flaws and the warts and the pressures and sometimes the strengths, you know, maybe misapplied. At a few levels, you know, you could find yourself saying, placing this individual in a different situation, you know, I kind of like this guy. We might play a little tennis, might do this. In this situation, though, whatever. So the point is that when you talk to people, you get a fuller picture. You understand. You don't necessarily agree with. You don't buy into it. You don't support it. But you understand where, you know, P.W. Botha, why he is who he is, and why he's sitting there with that kind of thing. So, and across the spectrum, you know, with African leaders and so forth and so on. So I think it was an important experience for me.
For sure.
Because I was in a job there where it was really a requirement, basically, to try to keep as open a mind as possible. Mm-hmm. Not everybody has that experience where they're called True. On to do that. So I understand that. But in our community, I think we're called on to do that. We've got to get past, we've got to get to the healing, and we've got to get past the divisiveness. Mm-hmm. And whatever you think about the politics of our community or of our nation, we can't be holier than thou. I mean, I definitely have my own set of political beliefs, But I also know, hey, I'm as susceptible like all human beings to stereotypical thought, to giving way to fear, to all those things, just like anybody else. So we've got to examine ourselves as we go forward.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of the more recent research on high conflict, which characterizes what we're talking about, where really below the issues, the hot button issues that you mentioned, like abortion or, you know, homelessness, that there are about four different real issues at hand, like power and control, respect, belonging, those sort of things. And it sounds like part of what this initiative could do is allow us to get to those real drivers.
Yes. Yeah, we... one of the things that I truly believe as a student of history and leadership is that the easy path, quote unquote, for people who want to seize power and control is to play to people's fears. And the way to do that has to be to I'm not a fan of the word othering, but the way to do that is to make people seem less than you are. Make them seem less than human. Make them seem not part of the mainstream. All of that sort of thing. And my caution to people is that when you see people playing to those fears through stereotypes, they may or may not believe the stereotypes. What they are doing is using that as a lever to gain power and control.
Mm-hmm.
And the rarely does that really, at the end of the day, work out for you if you are kind of like buying into that, okay? And, you know, at the end of the day, people who are seizing power and control on the backs of that kind of fear-mongering and stereotypical kind of thinking end up costing their own population, their own base, just as much or more than anybody else. Sometimes it takes years for that to play out, but typically it does. So I think it's important for people to understand that. You know, make your judgments, but make your judgments based on knowledge, not based on fear. And once you're feeling all that sense of fear, then you want to say, where is this coming from and how valid is it, okay? You know, because the truth is we live in a very privileged situation in the United States. And one of the things I often ask myself is, what are people so afraid of when they start talking about other groups? You know, what are they so afraid of about transgender? What are they so afraid of about black folk? What are they so afraid of about, you know, immigrants crossing the border and they're going to invade Shasta County? No, they're not. You know, what are they so afraid of women, female leaders, you know, in Congress or, you know, the White House or whatever? What are people so afraid of? Because, you know, I've worked in countries, believe me, where, I mean, the standard that we have here of life is a privileged standard, and there's plenty of stuff here for all of us to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN, and I'm in conversation with Larry Olmsted of United Way of Northern California. So, Larry, there's always people for initiatives like this who say, oh, it's naive to think that people will come together and talk and people are entrenched in their positions and they're the ones you can talk to and the ones that you can't. Or that there's too much at stake to be neutral. Some of the criticism, you know, some of the things that I've heard when yes. suggestions have been made about how we might talk to each other. I'm wondering how you address those issues and what you are sharing with people.
Yeah, excellent question. The first thing I would say is that while it sounds challenging, the initial ask is pretty easy. Treat each other with civility and respect, and support the idea that we can all sit around a table. We don't have to agree with each other, but we can all sit at the table. At the fundamental level, that's all we're asking. And that's not that big an ask, okay? I think most of us, if we had to during the course of a day, could be polite with each other and treat each other with respect and dignity. Practice that today, then let's see if I can do it tomorrow. Then let's see if I can do it the next day. Okay.
It might take practice, right? Might take some new skills.
Right. Yeah. And we understand that there's skills involved in how you talk with people and with others and how you think about those conversations in order to make that a possibility. That's part of our work, is kind of gathering up those skills and resources and putting them out there into the community so people can use them. Okay. So I feel like let's start there, not asking you to give up any of your values or beliefs. I think the second thing is that we are where we're at in our society because of a lot of factors, but what happens is it becomes a societal norm, okay? I feel like social media, for instance, has been a huge accelerant of this norm of divisiveness, right? But if that norm can be established one way, I think the norm can be established the other way, right? We're in a community that's a very faith-conscious community. What I know about faith through my own faith and through the school and so forth, is that most faiths actually value the idea that we treat people kindly. To me, it's always kind of frightening when I see people under the cloak of, evangelical whatever or what have you, are treating people with unkindly and with disrespect. So, mm-hmm. So we have those cultural pillars that are accessible to us, that we can hold on to and grab onto and start steering the ship back toward where it needs to be. I think that the other thing that I would say is that what we're looking to do is establish a norm. That doesn't mean every single person in the community is going to buy in. We understand that. And it is certainly everyone's right to believe what they believe, and okay, I'm not into this thing, it's all right. But what we hope is that as the norm is established, folks who are operating way outside that norm are hopefully going to say, hell, this isn't a good place to be. I'm way outside the group. I want to be closer to the group. I don't want to be all the way over here, right? I'm going to start feeling myself kind of excluded from things I want to be involved in, because a new norm has been established and I'm up here still being spouting off hate or racism or just meanness, misogynistic comments, all that stuff. And now I'm not being invited in. You're right. I'm not being invited to the party here. And that will start hopefully modifying, some behavior. So overall, this is a big challenge for the community as it is the nation, of course. But we think here we have an opportunity, because we think actually most people in Shasta County and North State actually want the same things. We think most people want government to work. We think most people want to care about their neighbors, and they want to continue to care about their neighbors. As an African-American here, I can tell you that I've enjoyed living here. I've enjoyed, I have great neighbors. Most people I've run into care about this community. So it is doable. It is very doable. We simply have to commit ourselves to the work.
Mm-hmm. What have you noticed, or has anything surprised you about who has become, like, come on board right away, and who maybe has wanted more information?
That's a great question. At this point, I think I've talked to about 130, 140 people
at least.
You would more or less classify as either civic leaders or people who are very civically active. I would say none of them think that there isn't a problem here that needs to be solved, okay? Mm-hmm. None of them. And this includes people on the way far right and on the way far left.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to say that the McConnell Foundation has come full in supporting this initiative. Reading Rancheria has come full in supporting this initiative. Key leaders, the district's attorney's office, as an example, they want to be involved. A variety of Reading officials, present and retired, want to be active and involved. So our utilities and so forth and so on. So we feel like there's definitely public sentiment for moving away from the divisiveness, at least here in Shasta County, and moving toward more dialogue, more respectful dialogue. And that, in a way, does not surprise me. I mean, I think this is a community of caring people, and they want to see, they think we can do better mm-hmm. than we're doing.
So if someone's listening and this is new to them, how can they learn more, and what would be your invitation to them?
Absolutely. This isn't a one-off. This is going to be rolling out over time. Right now, you can go to our website, norcalunitedway.org. You'll find a Building Bridges page. And one of the things that you'll see is these inaugural events. You can always just contact me directly. I'm happy to get your emails. L. Olmsted, Olmsted, at NorCalUnitedWay.org.
Larry, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, of course. Appreciate it. It's always great to support you and the work of SEJC. And I will mention that SEJC was the first organization to formally endorse Building Bridges. And the work that SEJC does is very, very important. I know you have some exciting stuff coming up. This is really about all of us as a community just saying we love Reading, we love Shasta County. We're gonna work together to move forward, and we can do this for sure. So thank you for having me.
Thank you, Larry. You've been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN, KKRN.org, community-supported radio. Thank you so much for listening and for donating as you can.
Don't you notice it always goes this? Always seems to end in pain. Better days.
Work at jacobacana.com or on Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, and other platforms.